This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in African American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Adam McNeil. On today's podcast, I got to honor Frere, Dr. Zebulon Vance Malitsky, author of Before Busing, a history of Boston's long Black freedom struggle. My brother, how you doing today?
I am good, man. Feeling good. Glad to be on with you.
Yes, sir, man. You know, we rapped for a good little minute before we got on, man. So I'm hyped to get the conversation going, man. So to get it cracking, why did you decide to write Before Busing?
Yeah, well, thank you first of all just for having me. I guess I decided to write Before Busing probably because of my own autobiography, my own background. I grew up in Boston, biracial in Boston. I think that's a relevant point. I'm just gonna just go there, and. Grew up in the, you know, basically the 1980s, 1990s, the period pretty much after this crisis in Boston known as busing, school desegregation. I think at a young age, I was always aware of the fact that something had happened in the city of Boston that I didn't quite understand, but I knew its name was busing. Because it was something that you just hear about a lot. Maybe being, you know, sort of that betwixt and between, you know, place, I think I was probably more sensitive to it because it was clear to me that something had taken place in the city of Boston that pretty much had really left marks on the city and on the psyche of the people. Both Black and white, but I pretty much, you know, grew up in the Black community of Boston. Never went to school outside of Roxbury until college, when I went to Boston College up the road in Chestnut Hill, and so I was quite aware that there was a past, a history, one that didn't seem too good, one that seemed pretty difficult for the people who lived through it. And I think, I don't know, I felt like I always wanted to do something about that. You know, and I'm only just realizing that as I'm saying this to you kind of, but, you know, I felt like something needed to be done about that. I didn't really feel good about the kind of way of life in terms of where race exists and how race operates in the city of Boston. And I think it's pretty well known today that this is an issue up in Boston, Massachusetts.
Yeah, man. And so before we skip a little bit further, take us back to your time at Boston College. How did your time in Chestnut Hill help form your own understanding about the Black experience and also in terms of this project as well. Because I say that because as our listeners will see when they read your book after going to UNC Press's website and clicking one of those purchase links, which they will, believe me, they will.
Okay.
You know, they'll also see your very long and very like in-depth acknowledgments page.
Yes, yes. People are talking about the acknowledgments. I guess I wrote a long acknowledgments.
Brother, hold on, man. You got to hold on, brother. You've been a little too...
The press was very generous.
Look, they got to be, bro, because let me see. This thing starts on page 195 and ends on 209.
My. Oh, my goodness.
For some people, that is a small chapter of a book.
Yeah, it's funny. People have remarked on it. You know, I had a lot of people to thank, obviously, you know. And I think, you know, you're right on target as always, because perhaps, again, because of the sort of journey being what it is and what it has been, not always an easy one, I might add, and I've spoken about that elsewhere and in other interviews and stuff, won't be easy in a city like Boston with this hypersensitive nature around race. But yeah, I had a lot of people to thank, you know, for keeping me sane in a lot of ways, you know, as you navigate through all those kinds of things. And I know, you know, before we were talking about, you know, some of the baggage that some people carry from having come up in the city, the biracial variant of Black, or just as we know, Black as we know it.
Yep.
And you know, I'm no exception at all to that. So I think the acknowledgments page is probably a little lengthy because of that. There's, you know, there's a lot of mentoring that had to take place. There was a lot of people who, you know, kind of as we do in the Black experience, in the Black cultural tradition, you know, people take people under their wing, look out for them, protect them, try to teach them how to fly, you know, and hope for the best. It doesn't always work out. And as I think back to some of those kinds of interventions, a lot of which happened at Boston College, and before, and on ongoing basis, a lot of not always Black men and women, but many, you know, we call them bridges or leaders, you know, or whatever, who did stand in the gap for me, as I think about it, and taught a guy named Zebulon Maletsky. See, this is the name, the everything. You know, it's been a rough road, bro. You know what I mean? It's not easy. You know, it's not easy. And then I had this stubborn insistence on identifying as such. Mm-hmm. You know, even though that is not always visually. This is a video as well as an audio podcast, correct? Is it not? So,
people. Oh, no. Well, it's just audio. But okay. When, like I said, once they hit click and they see the author page and they're like, oh, that's a brother. Oh, yeah. I see the pronouns here. I see the pronouns. Because I ain't gonna lie, there are some people that I do notice. I'm like, oh, let me see some of their more personal flourishes and be like, okay, are we using personal pronouns? Are we? And so but for those who might be wondering, he's already said it, but he's also, you can see it in his work as well.
Yeah, this is one case where I'll only do audio stuff from now on because this is helpful to me, see. But the visual, it doesn't always convey this meaning, but that's interesting in and of itself. But I mean, all of those things, I just threw my whole heart and soul into this thing, honestly. And I guess that's why I didn't really mind kind of just putting on paper, you know, to give my little testimony of people who helped me to it really as a way of explaining the work too, though.
Mm-hmm.
you know, because Boston is famous for being kind of a closed space in terms of outsiders or, you know, people, certain stories that may not get shared, may not be told. I think that a lot of the stuff in the book was only really possible to be recorded because of the space of, you know, kind of being from there. And then also, quite frankly, a lot of it, I was also even through my own family. I grew up with the, you know, it just so happened, this is just luck of the draw, but the Black side of my family is from Boston. My dad is from New York. If I was writing a book about New York, might have been a whole, it probably wouldn't have been about Black New York, you know, it would have been maybe, but that was important because, you know, as I think about it, these narratives, these oral histories, and more importantly, the oral tradition of storytelling, of how these things get passed down, you know, is trust is a part of it. And that's a important kind of bond that had to honor and keep sacred. So I had to really, explain. I'm really into explaining things. Like, this is, you know, this thing didn't just come out of nowhere. This is because of, you know, some love interventions, and also I think also the coming to fruition of the work of many generations of great teachers and families who were, you know, this was I'm not saying this was their dream, but we were encouraged, you know, in the schools that I attended in Boston, like the William Monroe Trotter, to tell our story and to tell our people's story. That was something that was ingrained at a very young age. And I guess I was listening, you know, it stuck with me. I didn't really have anything else to do, to be honest. You know, I said, you know, I can do this. Like, this is worth, you know, putting in 10 or 12 years of my life to try to tell this story.
And speaking of someone who probably knew you throughout the bulk of that story, it leads to our next question. And so you received two prominent blurbs on the back of Before Busing. One of them came from the dearly departed Dr. John H. Bracey from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And so this is what he writes of Before Busing. Quote, "This is a history of Black and white Bostonians and all their variations in ethnicity and national origin that few others, if any, could have written. Before Busing begins at the origins and guides us through victories and defeats, competing goals and contradictory strategies. There is a galaxy of personalities, some well known, many revealed for the first time, strong throughout, brilliant when combining existing scholarship and archival research with interviews and insights gained from personal experience. Before Busing gets Boston right," end quote. So please tell us, for those who did not have the chance to get to know Dr. Bracey, tell us about Dr. Bracey and what he means to you and to this project.
Ah, yes, the incomparable Dr. Bracey, yeah. Could weave, had a way with words, he did. And that is really like high praise too, because not one to give that out lightly. I could tell, it felt like he really meant that. And that's a great question. That's another great question because as you surmised, and it is true, Bracey, as someone who I had a chance to study with at UMass Amherst and study, you know, sort of at his feet in a way, it's how it felt, at least at the beginning. You know, he had a lot to do with this project, and I could say that he really I think I talked about that in the acknowledgments too. What didn't I talk about the acknowledgments? But he I think it was a question and an issue that interested him, as often can happen with, you know, in the graduate school process. Sometimes we may inherit the interest of people that we study with. And, you know, UMass being pretty not too far down the road in a way, the Mass Pike, you know, from Boston, and also being a place that receives a lot of students from Boston. Also having undergone, you know, a school desegregation situation out there in Western Mass in places like Springfield. I think, you know, I know this was of interest to him, and he had always encouraged me about it. He always encouraged me very gently, as Bracey's, you know, want to do sometimes, almost subliminally. I didn't totally have to be honest, I don't think I really quite had the confidence at first to take on such a topic. This is not an easy history, as you know. And also, when one undertakes to write to intellectualize a place that is already uber intellectualized and known for that, it can be a little intimidating. With all Boston's, you know, vaunted traditions of scholarship and intellectualism, Harvard University and the, you know, the great poets and the great writers and, you know, and Wadsworth Longfellow, Emily Dickinson's, and I don't know, all and on and on and on. And the sort of high ground that Boston, you know, was known to occupy in terms of education at all levels, made this sort of seemed like a very daunting task. But you know, Bracey did encourage me about it. He had useful suggestions of archival, you know, resources that could help in telling the story. And it's hard, you know, you really feel his loss, but, you know, he through the mentoring, you know, kind of the lenses and frameworks one would need to really see the multi-headed hydra of how race works in Boston. You know what I'm saying? It's working at multiple levels and simultaneously and exponentially. And so, and there I've got to also give credit, a lot of credit, to African American Studies. A shout out to Black Studies, and the discipline of which Bracey is one of the founders and pioneers. And I don't think one could really truly totally understand some of the ways that race, the complicated ways that race works, without some of those frameworks. And so, whether through conversations or, you know, the ongoing tedious process of graduate education, taking courses, doing the coursework, you know, taking the all that stuff that we do, it began to, I started to realize, first of all, I got nothing but time, and then I filled that time and used that time to prepare. I was low-key preparing to write this book, I think, for a long time. And I didn't do my dissertation on it. My dissertation was on a related topic, but in a different area. I was on interracial marriage in Boston, is what I, mm-hmm. the sort of slant that I guess I took on it as a way, which was helpful too, as a way to understand, you know, some of the other complicated aspects of Boston's legacy in terms of American history, the way it was seen by the South, the way it was viewed within the North itself, within New England, all of those things, was kind of that ended up being a useful way to kind of back into the subject, so to speak. But he was there, Bracey was there the whole way.
Through it all.
Yeah, through it all, with great suggestions and, you know, guiding somewhat stubborn and sometimes, you know, lazy graduate student, to be quite honest. Like,
hey, I'm there, I did it.
Running down these sources, and it took years. It really did take years. So he was also patient, and that helped.
Yeah. And so before we leave the conversation about Dr. Bracey, I've read the blurb that he provided for you for the book. When you first received it, how did it make you feel? Like what did it like? Because as you know, he was a part of your process for getting a dissertation. So that I can only imagine for me now what it would feel like for Dr. Dunbar to give me some blurred material for my dissertation and a later book. So take us to that initial moment when I don't know the full process of how this works, but at least when you first learned what the words I just read.
Yeah, there was a moment like that. I got an email from before the book came out from the editor. They were excited about the blurb. It felt good because I felt like, 'cause one thing I was always somewhat not nervous about, but you know, a little anxious about was filling that tall order that Boston requires in terms of getting this right, you know. So I mean, for him to say Dr. Maletsky, Professor Maletsky gets Boston right, I mean, that's like whoa, you know. And I was elated. That's kind of one of those premier moments that we all long for, and I think especially coming from someone who. Man, you know, how do we find the words? We're all going to be trying to figure this out in this coming year, you know, in the wake of his passing, to find the words to describe what Bracey, a person like Bracey, really, really meant. But we know that, I know that I've heard Bracey described as sort of a walking black encyclopedia of facts and knowledge and information. But he's also like this powerful storyteller who has touched kind of the touchstones, some important moments in Black history himself, was mentored and really comes from the firmament of, you know, that rich soil of Black thinking, I want to say, his own kind of walk. And so when somebody like that, you know, kind of says, okay, you walked it, you did it, you carried the water along the way enough. That just felt really good, right there. You know, it's I had always felt, and this kind of relates to one of your other questions. I had always felt that the story of Boston wasn't being told correctly. That's kind of a bold thing to say, but wasn't it just wasn't. There was a big piece missing. To me, it was fairly obvious what it was. There's an invisibility of Black Boston and Black Bostonians to some extent. And you know, we were kind of chatting about this earlier. When people think of Boston, they don't necessarily think of it as a Black space or Black city the way you might think of, say, Washington, D.C., or certainly not Washington, D.C., but let me start, like, let me, that's a high bar. Let me go back, New York, Chicago, you know, Philadelphia, or something like that. And indeed, Boston always had a somewhat smaller Black population. The numbers tell that story, but I think it's just that is the sort of, you know, kind of things that you find or feel in other cities. You know, Boston's always been kind of, I think, especially a lot of Black folks, mostly because of this rough history of school desegregation and busing, just not seen as a place that's welcoming or positive. And so that's another reason why I felt like this story needed to be told, you know, W.B. Du Bois and William Monroe Trotter and, you know, and Booker T. Washington, you know, all involved and interested in Boston at various times for various reasons. You know, the shot heard round the world that started off the American Revolutionary War. You know, was a Black man by the name of Crispus Attucks in Boston. you know, Boston's got some like important connections to, I should say Black Boston has some important connections to American history, and American history has some important connections and contributions that were brought about by this small but mighty, you know, kind of community of mm-hmm. thinkers, intellectuals, activists, and leaders, and thought leaders, you know. So of course this is the best kept secret, you know, that we got to like let people know what some of the contributions, you know. And as we were joking, we have New Edition. Okay.
Yes.
That's actually game right there, you know.
Yes.
It all started in a place called Orchard Park Project, you know. So
yes.
This
yes.
We have to claim these things.
Gotta claim it, man. Because and for those who might be wondering, where does this even come from? And so Brother Zebulon and I were rapping before we press record, because I watch a lot of basketball, and anytime you have some of these prominent broadcasts in whatever city that they're in, they'll choose music from the city as the outro to a commercial. Anytime it's in Boston Celtics, or maybe even the New England Patriots, they'll choose something from that catalog, from New Edition, BBD, and such, especially those guys on TNT, the NBA on TNT guys, and Shaq, Kenny, and all those guys, and Ernie, and Chuck. And so those guys who just play it all the time. And actually, you know, you had mentioned before about interviews. And so one question I do have in terms of interviews, how, because I also think about other contributions to Boston. The greatest documentary series in U.S. history is Boston based, Eyes on the Prize. And so like, and that's based on interviews. Some of the greatest interviews that, especially when you're able to find the long form versions. And so it makes me think about the interviews that you had for the book. So in Before Busing, can you describe some of the interviews that you conducted for this particular book?
Yeah. And absolutely. I was, you know, I, like the rest of the country, you know, watched and remembered Eyes on the Prize, remember winning at all kinds of awards, and was blown away then by the power of oral histories. You know, man, you're a good interviewer. See, this is, you're right. That was a big thing. Henry Hampton, you know, the man who started Blackside, you know, and I had a chance actually to meet him years ago. It's a story I tell sometimes at Boston College, matter of fact. He was getting an honorary doctorate from BC that was my freshman year of college. That would have been 1993. And, you know, they asked me to be his usher and stuff like that. But, it was perfect because I had gotten involved, you know, again, those mentors. There's a group called the Boston Association of Black Journalists, offshoot of the National Association. And some of the folks at that time who were the sort of cutting edge and known Black journalists in the city were members of that. And I actually got a scholarship, and I got a chance to, you know, Henry Hampton was honored at that. So I kept kind of like, you know, 18-year-old Zebulon, like totally clueless. Not understanding. I'm be honest, like I didn't understand it, what was happening at the time. But you know, I guess they were sort of precursors to the future, future interests. And no, the my favorite episode, hands down, was always, you know, that part of the Eyes on the Prize 2 section that talked about Boston. Was absolutely blown away by that, and only in time came to understand that. You know, that the part of that was because Blackside itself was based in Boston, and then later, you know, which I learned in some of the interviews I did for this book, you know, you know, people whose couches Henry Hampton was like, you know, staying on and who helped him to get Blackside going and stuff like that. So much to say about this, but anyway, I thought by far it's the most powerful way to convey history, especially hard history, confusing history. You know, you know, listening to the words of some of the people that are in that now famous episode, like Gene McGuire, you know, talking about as a new school teacher, walking into these, you know, classrooms that were, you know, sort of falling down around themselves, no pens or pencils or resources and books, a school named after, you know, one of those 19th century, you know, educators, of which are so many famous names in education that emerge out of Boston. You know, just the symbolism of the Boston or New England schoolhouse, you know, all of that, what that represents, you know, in like in American life and culture. And yet here's this, you know, kind of ignored and under-resourced community in the heart of it all, the place that, you know, where public education started, first high school in America, first public high school, Boston Latin School, and Harvard itself, and all the other, you know, citadels of higher education and of at all education at all levels. It's a paradox, you know. I mean, you really just, and this is the biggest thing that Bracey taught me, was common sense. Like, these paradoxes, you know, the disparity between the myths of a place like Boston and the reality, you know, for Black folks. And even the idea that Boston was part of the civil rights narrative, I thought was a profound statement, you know, with Eyes on the Prize, because you got, I don't know, so many episodes, you can't tell every story, you know, but the fact that Henry Hampton and then all the other people involved saw that as an important part of that narrative of civil rights in the North, but just civil rights in general, because even though the Eyes on the Prize looks at a lot of places in the North, I mean, it's mainly, I think the most of the places, most of the topics are places in the South. So, I always felt that was encouraging. I'll just put it that way. There was potential there. If they saw Boston as part of that struggle that SNCC and other groups were pushing for, that this was indeed, you know, the outpost of Freedom North, in a way, or one of them, an important one, then it seemed to me good enough. There was enough clues there that suggested there's more to that story. And literally, that's all I really had to go on. Much to my delight, you know, as I dug deeper, I started to realize just how deep those connections were. This was not just Northern friends of SNCC, you know. They were doing, there's a lot of overlap, and there's a lot of people doing important things, SNCC-like things, I want to say, for lack of a better way to put it, freedom schools, building curricula, you know, challenging in innovative ways, like just as innovative as Mississippi Freedom Summer or other approaches, is the kinds of things you've seen happening on the ground in Boston. I mean, they really just, with all those brilliant people, and there's a lot of smart people in Boston. That's another thing that's hard to do with this history. When you have to interview some people who are very bright and so on, and the connections, and it's all just this colorful, you know, cascade of information and intellectual connections and insights, et cetera. That also could be a little bit daunting, but I just reveled in it. You know, I turn the mic, kind of like what you do, turn the microphone on and let people tell their stories, right, wrong, or otherwise, corroborate it with the evidence, make sure, you know, because sometimes people's recollections fade and that kind of thing. But that was the joy, Anyway, but I'm thank you for noticing. Oral history was a big part of this book, purposefully, so intentionally. I wanted to do it that way.
Yeah, and so transitioning, so we're going to transition with this next question from a production of the late 20th century to something that for most people takes them to the late 19th century. And so typically people see separate but equal, the separate but equal doctrine really as a Southern phenomenon due to the term's attachment, as many know, to the Plessy decision. What surprising role does separate but equal play in Boston's long freedom struggle?
Yeah. This was another kind of thing that I don't know about other people, but I didn't have like every single part of the book when I first started the book. I had some notions of what I was looking for, but it wasn't until I really got into the archives and got, you know, opened up some of these legal books and things myself to try to really trace this. But I've also noticed a trend in Boston of kind of, and it's a little bit part of the myth making, Boston's just full of myths, you know, the city upon a hill. I mean, that's right from day one, never mind the sort of general kind of myth making that happens in the North about somehow being better than places in the South. You know, this is Boston. We don't have those problems here kind of mentality. But I also noticed that I think people naturally would always make the assumption that that if there was a place that, you know, probably had, you know, integrated schools, it would probably be Boston. That is partly the case because Brown versus Board of Education, the decision handed down by the Warren Court, mentions that about Boston, that it's a model, and has had a long history of desegregated schools, but they didn't exactly tell the how they came to be. There was a great book that came out, I don't know, even about 15 years now. It's called Sarah's Long Walk. That also does a similar kind of thing. It's a history of the Roberts family, Sarah Roberts and her father, who sued the city of Boston because Sarah has to walk by five other schools before getting to the one school in Boston at that time that allowed Black students to attend there. Part of this is like the hubris of publishing. It sounds like, you know, oh, wow, this is like Brown versus Board of Education too. You know, somebody who, you know, who is basically, because it's very similar to some of the stories that came out of, you know, the Brown lawsuit. But what is underplayed oftentimes is the fact that the Roberts case was, I won't say whether it was successful or unsuccessful, but technically speaking, it lost. The Roberts lost their case against Boston. The courts ruled that the city of Boston was not guilty of maintaining, you know, two distinct school systems. And if it was, then it was actually legal to do so. And they didn't use the term separate but equal in Roberts versus Boston in 1849, but essentially used the same language of separate but equal. And in fact, so much so that by the time Homer Plessy's case in 1896 comes before the Supreme Court, Plessy versus Ferguson, different set of issues, but the judge actually in the decision cites Roberts as supporting this idea of separate but equal. This is of course, the Plessy, I'm sure your listeners will know Plessy versus Ferguson, is the doctrine that established, is the decision, I should say, that's established the separate but equal doctrine, not based just on Louisiana standards or Southern standards, but on, you know, good old Boston, Massachusetts, you know, the place that's supposed to be above such things and all that. And so I found that pretty profound. But then again, I've seen a lot of other examples just like that, things that we naturally assume are Southern phenomena that actually find their inception point in the North. And this is just one example of that. So people got to know, you know, that some of these ideas that we attribute to and arrogantly and falsely attribute to some kind of Southern backwardness or something like that, you know, have their beginnings in the North, and in Northern places, if for no other reason, that, you know, for all those reasons that Boston is the first public library, the first, because it's first and earliest in the United States of America, right? Meaning, if America has problems with race, then look to its origin points. And that takes you to Jamestown, but it also takes you to Massachusetts, you know, for the origins of some of those things. So to think that Boston would somehow be an exception to the systemic racism of, you know, of settler colonialism and the apocalypse thereof, then is a real oversight and is to fall subject to the myth making. So I was trying to like cut through that, you know, see Boston for what it is. You know, the same reason we always have to remind people that, oh, you know, there was slavery in Boston. You know, there was, yeah, I live in New York now. Absolutely. We do the same. Yeah. The reason you always have to remind people is because you're countering against the countervailing myth that has gathered so much steam over the years to make people forget that there was ever slavery in New England at all.
100%. And, gotta show love to your shout out to Gerald Horn, Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, which I see you also got a good citation in the book as well. And so we're actually going to do an interesting thing here where we flip the understanding geographically from one part of the country to the other. So we're going to talk about somebody that is always a controversial figure to talk about in terms of Booker T. Washington. And so for some, obviously, Booker T. Washington is Southern, as a Southern person, Virginia, Hampton, Tuskegee. But your book, Before Busing, chronicles an interesting set of interactions that he had with Boston's Black political establishment. And so can you talk to us about Washington's kind of role in the long Black freedom struggle in Boston in the late 19th and early 20th centuries?
Yeah. You know, again, this really does bring things back to John Bracey, because, you know, this was a topic of that he's finds, you know, very interesting. And I guess, you know, in just being around quite a few professors who found this topic, you know, quite interesting all the time, you know, was always sort of being mentioned. And the clues were there, you know. I knew that, I always remember that, you know, I mean, I think we, most of us know, you know, that Booker T. Washington starts the National Negro Business League in Boston. That's kind of a little factoid that you hear. Ah, okay, that's interesting. You know, and I knew that Washington had a full out, you know, a kind of attack, which was we call the Boston Riot, where, you know, William Monroe Trotter showed up at a church that he was speaking at and all hell broke loose, is something that us, you know, historians of the Black experience tend to call the Boston Riot. But, you know, even knowing those kind of facts, I didn't really put it all together till I started to put it together in a sense of having kind of a clue there. Why? Okay, so I knew that he starts it there, but why? Why did you start it there? what was the focus or interest in Boston of Booker T. Washington? And that's still a question that's still open for debate, because no one probably will quite know exactly why, but you know, considering the fact that he spent so much time in Boston, he clearly had an interest in the city in various ways. He had an interest in being kind of benighted, you know, by the establishment, the Eastern or New England establishment, namely Harvard, I would say. When I found out that he had received an honorary degree from Harvard, a doctorate from Harvard, I said, okay, that's another interesting thing. And then read about the fact that he's there even at the dedication of the 54th Massachusetts.
Had no idea.
I didn't know that. Once you start, yeah, right. I don't think a lot of people necessarily do. Some people know, but you know, so it's just like, but this is his fault. I mean, he's there all the time. He's trying to be there, right? It's not our job to understand why Booker T. Washington would be popping up in all these places in Boston, but he's there because, I suppose, as we all try to figure out the panopticon of, you know, the Booker T. Washington is a very hard person to understand in so many ways. So many layers to this very interesting American life. But I think clearly he, in the same way he sought, you know, the investment and support of white philanthropists and industrialists and, you know, captains of industry, he also wanted a piece of that, you know, New England kind of I don't know what word it would be, but that kind of, you know, that pedigree, I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it begins to make sense when you understand the ambition of Booker T. Washington, in terms of, you know, his amassing of power, of course. Oh, okay, now this makes more sense. Of course, it's also confusing because Booker T. Washington talked so much about, he talked against Northern education, first of all, right? You know, famously, you know, we saying Black people don't need to be, you know, learning about literature and all this, you know, kind of the stuff they do up there in the North, the liberal arts. I mean, that's part of his rhetoric. It is part of his whole sort of ideology, you know, cast down your bucket where you are. He always focused so much on the South and ridiculed, actually. I mean, he ridiculed like Northern process of education, especially for Black people, right? Booker T. Washington is so hard to understand. I mean, he used to warm up the audience with like darky jokes and stuff like that. Like what? You know, like what? Talk about throwing people off the scent. So I just decided to look at the facts, you know, and then come to find out, you know, even though he's ridiculing Northern education, he sends his own son and daughter to be educated in New York. He owns a summer home in the Weymouth in North Shore of Boston.
Yeah.
Right. So okay. So we already know Washington is the first class hustler, okay? he says one thing, does another thing, right? So in that pursuit, he had this, and I think he was also very fearful of some of the opposition that came from there, like William Monroe Trotter, although when Washington's at his height, William Monroe Trotter, no one knows who Trotter is yet. Washington is the preeminent, you know, voice and leader of that time period. So, and lastly, because this struggle is about education, Washington's position on industrial education matters, right? He would have rethought and changed, as I got going and looking into that, into his papers, looking at all the research, he would have set things in motion that would have been that would have impacted education, not only in Boston, but obviously in the country as a whole. Perhaps using, you know, if it could work in Boston, then you know, the heart and home of education, then it could work anywhere. But obviously that idea was never fully realized. But I think that, so it just seemed to me that the triangulation of the ideology and thinking of William Monroe Trotter, that of Du Bois, the preeminent, you know, thinker of 20th century, and Washington, also as educator and as thinker, because that's what they all kind of had in common. Trotter doing that more so through the newspaper, but that three-way, you know, kind of fight with other voices involved as well, certainly, is going to have implications for education in the 20th century, and indeed just leadership and direction of the race as a whole. And it happens, a lot of it is happening in Boston.
And one of the things is, we get close to wrapping up here, that I thought that section really did well. As someone who did so much of the Black Heritage Trail tours, I did a lot of those that directed people on Black Boston, especially Black Boston's 18th and 19th, early 20th century history. It's fascinating hearing about the connections that Washington had with the abolitionists, the descendants of abolitionists, which I think to me, like, I feel like, you know, in no other place do you really hear about the legacy of abolitionism more than here. I live in Philadelphia now. Laura knows there's the Colored Convention movement is founded here in Philadelphia. And a lot of the Black political class here, Philadelphia, or here, New York, and you know, Baltimore. But in no other place does the legacy of that, right? Because then you connect it to the founding of the NAACP and Garrison and a lot of those different families. And so to me, that was actually the section that really, I was like, oh, dang, I did not realize the enmeshing of that as much. Maybe because I'm writing a dissertation where I'm so focused on like that 18th century, like American Revolutionary era and before. But it is something that to me, I think for listeners, is really going to help them really ground themselves in that transitional moment, you know, as we see with Du Bois and Washington and Trotter. And the like.
Yeah. That was actually very surprising to me as well. I think that's when I started to really realize I kind of fall in love with intellectual history a little bit. That chapter is really the one where I talk about that. And I also kind of, as I was saying, backed into it with, and really came to realize that in my dissertation, which was about interracial marriage in Boston. And I basically just looked at different, you know, prominent Black leaders and thinkers, how they handled the issue of interracial marriage was very interesting to me. You know, they kind of didn't, on the one hand, didn't want to be, you know, so outspoken on the issue, but at the same time realized that it was an important right that had to be defended, even if they didn't necessarily agree with it. And that dilemma is pretty much, you know, what I talked about in my earlier work. And so it forced me to look at, I looked at how Du Bois thought about interracial marriage in the pages of the Crisis. This is my other, you know, my other earlier project. And I also wanted to see where Booker T. Washington stood on the whole thing. And that was interesting to me, that exactly, that the descendants of William Lloyd Garrison, in this case, I'm talking about Boston, you know, were extremely supportive of Booker T. Washington, you know, spending their own money to send him on trips, supporting him, and even at Harvard, especially, you know, not that they were necessarily all abolitionists, but that, you know, kind of their support of which legitimizes Washington so much, is important, right? That mm-hmm. that kind of support and endorsement in a sense of Washington's ideas is an important thing. And so it challenges our kind of like linear sense about how things, or at least for me, how things work. You know, it falls in that same category of the paradoxes of Boston. You might assume one thing about it. You might assume, no, they wouldn't support, you know, this kind of mentality that rejected, you know, civil rights or talked about, you know, this one of accommodation position, because they're more progressive, but they do, right? And a lot of that speaks to, there's a scholar by the name of Mark Schneider who wrote about this years ago. This was his dissertation, Boston Confronts Jim Crow, a book that came out when I was in college. And that helped me to understand that things are not what they seem. You have to look a lot more closely. I also learned and realized that the myth-making can go the other way too. We might assume, oh, Boston is the headquarters of abolition, you know, or one of the major headquarters, at least, mm-hmm. of progressive abolitionism in the country, because there's all different kinds of abolitionist approaches. The Quakers in Philadelphia had a different approach, you know, if Benjamin Franklin had a very different approach than mm-hmm. the up in New York, with the gradual emancipation, or even the movement of people, you know, re-emigration schemes and all that stuff. But as progressive as Boston's abolitionists were, not everybody in Boston was an abolitionist, though. You 100%. Know, right? You know, you have this. It's a small band who did something so powerful that you might think the whole city agrees with this kind of thing, but that was also never the case. So one could be an abolitionist. I learned very painfully that, but not necessarily believe in the social equality with Black people, or even want to be around Black people on a personal level. These are all things. You know, you were so right when you talked about Bracey. These are a lot of things I learned from him, you know, in his showing us the inconsistencies and the various sort of paradoxes that exist, that forced us, you know, in my education at least, and I think a lot of us who went to UMass, shout out to UMass, Amherst, Afro-Am Studies, department, you know, it showed us that things are not always what they seem, and you have to look more deeply. I think that just because one is the descendant of an abolitionist doesn't mean that they necessarily also carry the same beliefs, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was surprising. And indeed, you know, like I was saying, Mark Schneider, he wrote about, you know, the extinguishing of the progressive abolitionist flame, you know, in Boston by the end of the 19th century, that passion around fighting for equality was starting to flicker. And of course, we haven't even talked, you know, by the 20th century, Boston is a whole different space but explainable reasons. You know, this is what I love about history. There's measurable, you know, to some extent, it's not like a perfect science, but there are some good reasons why things ended up being the way they were in Boston in the 20th century.
And for those who are looking to see that fine transition, you got to go get the book and see why Professor Sean Alexander said, "This is a significant contribution that will do much to shift discussion around Black America's long struggle for civil rights from the South to the North and expose how African Americans in the North, particularly urban Boston, use their particular environments, politics, and social conditions to respond to the rapidly changing social and political situation. before busing skillfully shows how the community of Black Bostonians unified and built coalitions to define freedom, citizenship, and equality. And y'all, we have had the amazing opportunity to chat with my brother Zebulon Vance Maletsky, who is the Associate Professor of Africana Studies at Stony Brook University. We've been on here to talk about his brand new book, published by our friends at UNC Press, Before Bussing, A History of Boston's Long Black Freedom Struggle. And so y'all, I'm very happy to have interviewed my good friend here and look forward to seeing him in a few days down in Jacksonville, Florida at ASALIS Conference, the Association for the Study of African American Life and History. Didn't even have to look up or look down to remember. All up in here in the head. It's been many, many years. It's been many, many years. And so, y'all, I am your host of New Books in African American Studies, a podcast channel on New Books Network. Until next time, y'all, over and out.